London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. This week, we bring you the voices of Wales from the Royal Eisteddfod. We span seven counties from London to Devonshire by automobile, and we examine a recent pronouncement of our government on the burning question of rearmament. And that matter of major concern to us, to yourselves, and to the world should properly come first. The British government, like other governments of the Atlantic Treaty powers, recently answered the pertinent question put to each of them by Washington, what are your proposals in the matter of increasing your defences? And the British memorandum in reply has stated that over the next 3 years, Great Britain will spend on additional defensive armament a sum approaching $10,000 million. $10 billion, as you would say. Well, it's recognized here, of course, that American assistance is vital to this new and vastly augmented defense program, and it's not possible to assess its effect until the full extent of American help is known. But some of the probable repercussions can be foreseen, and these are discussed for us now by our special contributor, Roland Fox.
It's evident from the memorandum that the attitude adopted by the government was that, so far as this country is concerned, the immediate problem is one of equipment shortage rather than manpower shortage. We have a substantial reserve of trained manpower, 1 million national servicemen, and the men trained in the last war, so that the manpower position is regarded as considerably better than it was in the years immediately preceding the last war. So the expert study which the government put in hand on receipt of the American request toward the end of last month was directed principally towards ways and means of increasing military equipment.
As a result of this approach,
it can be concluded that by far the biggest proportion of the total bill now proposed would be spent on equipment. And a reliable estimate is that if the full program were operated, our output of defense equipment and stores would be at least double what it is today. In that case, the impact on industry and on the country's investment program must be considerable. The extent of American assistance would obviously have a great effect on the intricate problem which would confront the government in London of working out how to spread the proposed new burden between investments, home consumption, and exports. Figures available in London enable some comparison to be made between the respective positions of the United Kingdom and the United States. According to these, our unemployment figure is 1.5%, and 3% of the working population are in the armed forces. America is said to have 5% unemployment, and a figure for June of 2% of the working population in the armed forces. In this country, we have an average working week of 45 hours, compared with America's 40 hours. And America's national income is estimated at 8 times the size of this country's at present rates of exchange. There's no doubt that the proposed new program is very formidable, and it's estimated here in London that, excepting for the first year after the war, it would involve us in the highest rate of expenditure on armaments that the country has ever known in peacetime.
Rearmament or not, and world crises notwithstanding, Wales remains, as she always has been, a land of poetry and song. And her music matches the mood of her black, craggy mountains, her foaming, rocky rivers, her rugged coasts, and the dark greenness of her deep, winding valleys. The Welsh Eisteddfods have long been the classic scenes of contests between mass choirs, contests in which vast audiences are swept into voice with them, all Wales a sea of song. The Royal Eisteddfod at Caer Philly is in full swing right now, and a taste of it is brought to us by our Welsh reporter, Griffith Jones, who set out for Caer Philly by train.
The Eisteddfod had started even on the British railways. Some young men in the next compartment were singing a dim tune in harmony. Next to me, a bearded pard, who at least looked like a bard, was reciting a poem in resonant Welsh. At every station, our Eisteddfod forces were augmented. A laughing girl was bringing her harp with much male help. Fiddles and trombones mingled with mackintoshes and umbrellas on the luggage racks of the railway compartments. And when I reached Caer Philly and the great pavilion, I heard first a Welsh hymn sung during the official Eisteddfod opening. But this was the great day of the bands. In the surrounding hills, several brass bands were practicing even before breakfast. Across the steep, narrow streets, everywhere, banners and streamers greeted you. Voices like quicksilver added to the greetings. There was always one special word that captivated the ear, the word croeso, and the Welsh mean it too, welcome. Before I had walked 50 yards, I was halted by an effusive, "How are you since last year?" In Welsh, of course. It was Mr. Jones from Penmyn Mawr. 100 yards down the road, Mrs. Jones from Fishta took me warmly by the hand. Further on, there were Mr. Jones from Ibadan, Nigeria, and Mr. Jones from Mount Carmel, Pennsylvania, waiting nostalgically. All day long, every day, it will be like that. It's like being a member of the royal family on a handshaking tour. Indeed, every Jones and every Williams is a Prince of Wales this week.
The music of Merry England brings us back over the Welsh border, right back to London, in fact. But only for a moment, since we thought you'd like to hear of just one westward journey that waits to charm the traveller by road. It wasn't so very different in the old coaching days, but the tarmac roads of today, even the narrow ones, they're graded and dust-free, and they roll silently beneath your eagerly cruising motor car. From London to Torquay on the southwest coast of Devon, well, 200 miles perhaps, and Sheila Stewart has brought us a tourist's eye view.
It was evening when I left London, having decided to cover as much as possible of my 200-mile drive before dusk. On the heathland of Surrey, the heather was a mist of purple in the evening sunlight. But by the time I reached Salisbury Plain, the light was fading. On my right, where the sun had set, there was still a red glow in the sky. And on the left, a full moon like a golden guinea was rising out of the mist. The great plain stretched away on each side, mile upon rolling mile of it, mysterious and somehow eerie in the darkening evening. And silhouetted against the sky was the grey stone pile of the ancient Druid temple, Stonehenge. You know, they say that if you stand on Stonehenge at midnight when the moon is full, you will see the Druids conducting their religious rites. And looking around me that evening, well, it looked quite possible. At least, I wasn't prepared to try. Well, now it was time to find somewhere to sleep for the night. And I found it in the little country town of Gillingham in Dorset. Let no one tell you that English country hotels are bad, while there are still places like the Phoenix and people like the Joneses to run them. Mine host was standing outside as I drove up, and he really lived up to that honorable old title. I was welcomed, fed, though it was long past the normal dinner hour, and shown into a comfortable little room where the furniture shone with polish and the sheets were scented with lavender. And so, after a good night's sleep, a magnificent breakfast, and many promises to return, and I will too, I was on my way again, through the West Country, where fields of golden wheat rippled in the breeze, where the grass in the valleys is almost unbelievably lush and green, where little white cottages with thatched roofs nestle in the villages, and the narrow roads wind between the hedges starred with wildflowers, and where life is as peaceful and as slow as the soft West Country speech of the folk who live there. And so, to my journey's end, Torquay, that quaint seaside town, almost tropical with its palm trees on the waterfront, and the white houses and hotels in tiers built into the steep hillsides. Yes, if you want to see beauty, and a great variety of beauty crammed into a small space, travel through the English countryside in all the glory of high summer. It takes a bit of beating.
And now for our postscript from guest London columnist, MacDonald Hastings. Mac.
The other day, an American friend of mine asked me why we British aren't doing more about the communist aggression in Korea. Well, I hope that Roland Fox's report in this London column on the vast new rearmament program that we're undertaking will settle any fears that you may have on your side that Britain doesn't mean business. It's true that in the face of the immediate challenge in Korea, we have so far only been able to send a token force. But the explanation for that is very easily given. Britain is already involved in a less spectacular but equally serious military campaign against communist-inspired guerrilla forces in Malaya. We are also providing the garrison for Hong Kong. In short, we are already deeply committed to the guarding of two vital strategic areas in the Far East. Never mind our responsibilities in the West. At present, Our resources, like yours, are insufficient to meet our immediate military needs. Like you, we've planned in these past few years not for war, but for peace. But you need have no doubt that in the face of the challenge, we won't be with you all the way. And make no mistake that this huge rearmament program we're undertaking in Britain isn't going to hurt. And more so because in the past 6 months, there have been solid indications that at last, after the years of austerity, we have been recovering a peacetime economy. Rationing has been steadily decreasing, the shops are filled again with all the pleasant peacetime goods which since pre-war have been unobtainable. Every visitor from your side of the world has been remarking how much better things are here than they expected. Indeed, there has been every reason to hope that when martial aid ended in 1952, Britain would be standing firmly on her own feet again. Now, it's inevitable, I'm afraid, that luxury goods will be in short supply again. A rise in taxation levels here, already the highest in the world, looks unavoidable. It may be that some forms of rationing will have to be restored. Military service is already extended and reservists are being called back to the colours. If you ask me what people are saying about it, the general opinion, rightly or wrongly, is still that we shall manage to avoid a world war, but only at the terrible price of uprooting our national economy all over again. What we have to do now is to prove that we can do it without letting communism creep in through the back door. That, presumably, is Russia's hope. It won't be gratified. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a radio digest presented by Peter Watson and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC. That was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.